don't have a clear idea of why rates are higher here yet.
Serious birth defects in Alaska are twice that of the rest of the nation. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a setback for Yupik language voting assistance.
It's a difficult process to have to do a translation on the spot in front of a voter, and different people translate things differently.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP, proud to support public broadcasting in Alaska.
The legislature this weekend is finishing up a five-day break with members set to return to their special session dealing with the natural gas pipeline and a package of energy-related issues on Monday. They now face deadlines for all the questions they started with, some of them dating back to the beginning of last month. Joining us from Juneau is APRN's Dave Donaldson. Hi, Dave.
Hi there.
Dave, first of all, the pipeline. It's been under consideration for a long time now. How long does this continue?
There's a lot of talk and complaint about it's taking so long to deal with this question, but there's another side to it, and that is that the law that the legislature itself passed gave them 60 days to deal with it. So it will be decided one way or the other by August 2nd. That's the 60-day limit that they're facing. The House is actually scheduled to vote on it on Tuesday, and that leaves the Senate another 11 days to decide. And I'm told that they have some other testimony they want to take. I don't know exactly who they want to talk to, but they will actually hold more hearings.
Dave, the call for the special session also included some changes to the Power Cost Equalization Program. Have you seen anything on that?
I know rural legislators began talking among themselves, wanting an increase in the electricity rate allowed under PCE. It's now 52.5 cents, and they want it increased to $1.12. That seems to still be there. It's likely that they're going to get that $1.12, but they also want the laws that sets a ceiling on how much one customer can use per month. They want that rewritten instead of monthly limit. The talk now is that it would be an annual limit.
Dave, do you think that the firing of Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan fits into the puzzle at all for the next couple of weeks?
I think so, definitely. You know, I have not seen a change in cabinets this causing this much uproar in all the years that I've been here. And frankly, that's a lot. The discussion now is that at some point, legislators are so upset that they will hold some hearings on it. They want to think of having witnesses actually under subpoena. They will testify under oath. And the stories released this week about the governor and the family problems with this particular state trooper, these were pretty harsh. But no one's ever yet made a link between what happened in that trooper situation and Monaghan's firing. Now, the governor says there's not a link, and Monaghan has just so far refused to address the direct questions. Legislators don't know, even those that are not terribly upset. Well, they are a little upset. I think they all want to see if that connection exists.
And do you think, would it affect the vote on any of the other questions they went to Juneau to settle?
Yeah, it'll decide their, it'll delay them from taking up other issues for a part of it. And I think that, this whole Monaghan issue could affect the vote because the way they're looking at it is that this politics as usual, which has become a kind of almost a dirty word catchphrase at times, it's based on trust as much as anything else. And so if the vote were held had been held last week, the gas line would have passed. I was convinced of that. At this point, I don't know how things are going to happen, and I think that there will be some effect anyway on how the votes are going to go.
All right, Dave. Well, thanks for keeping an eye on those issues for us.
My pleasure.
APRN's Dave Donaldson reporting from Juneau. A federal judge has ruled that Yupik is not a historically written language. The ruling is part of a lawsuit brought on by Yupik elders and tribes against the state of Alaska and the city of Bethel. The ruling by Judge Timothy Burgess could limit the kind of language assistance the state is required to provide. For member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
The civil case is still being litigated, but the decision could diminish the chances of Yupik being placed on ballots in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. The lawsuit was brought on by Yupik speakers who say that election officials have not provided adequate translations on ballots and of other election information. Their case was taken up by the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska. Attorney Jason Brandeis says that Yupik translations have been left in the hands of local poll workers.
It's a difficult process to have to do a translation on the spot in front of a voter, and different people translate things differently.
Federal laws contained in the Voters' Rights Act compel election offices across the country to provide written assistance for minority languages where they are commonly used. But that language must be defined as historically written. Yupik has taken on various written forms since the first creation in the late 1800s. The latest version was devised in the 1960s and is used today. Burgess's ruling says that history is too short to classify the language as historically written. But the exact effect of the ruling is still unclear to the parties involved. It came unexpectedly on July 8th and was provided in oral form only. The Attorney General Office, who is defending the state, and the ACLU are waiting for a written ruling from the judge. Brandeis says it should be coming soon.
He was going to issue a more detailed description and reasoning for his decision at a later date.
According to the Attorney General's office and the ACLU, the ruling still leaves room for a final decision that would mandate some form of language assistance. Brandeis says there are other circumstances in which it is called for.
The Voting Rights Act also allows for written assistance when written assistance would help provide clear, effective oral assistance.
Even without a final determination, the Division of Elections is beefing up their translation efforts. Division Director Gail Fanumi says they have created Yupik CDs and other election materials. They are still waiting federal approval for distribution, but Fanumi says the CDs will provide essential voting information in Yupik.
Polling place hours, voting instructions, more information about getting voter assistance at the polling place, primary election ballot choices.
And for the upcoming primary election on August 26th, they will provide poll workers with written ballot translations.
So the consistency of the translation of the ballot measure questions will remain the same throughout the state.
There is no date set for a final ruling on the case. In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
A new study shows babies born in Alaska are at much greater risk for congenital heart conditions, fetal alcohol syndrome, and other major birth defects than infants in the nation as a whole. The State Department of Health and Social Services conducted the research. Department analyst Janine Shellhorn says Alaska babies are twice as likely to be born with a serious birth defect than infants elsewhere, and health officials aren't sure why.
We really don't have a clear idea of why rates are higher here yet.
The study includes 7 years of data from the Alaska Birth Defects Registry. Shellhorn says researchers looked at conditions known to increase chances for birth defects, such as drinking and smoking during pregnancy. Even when the conditions were eliminated from results, Alaskans still ranked significantly higher.
We did do some look at some identifiable risk factors, and we controlled for those and still came out with increased prevalence here in Alaska.
Shellhorn says Alaska Native infants are at more than twice the risk for major birth defects than white infants born in Alaska. Birth defects are the leading cause of infant death and childhood disability. They result in more than $2.5 billion a year in hospital costs nationwide, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaskans call for censuring the Supreme Court justices over the Exxon Valdez punitive damages decision.
These activist Supreme Court judges, their task is to interpret law, not make new law.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by The Alaska Engineering News Fund, whose contributors include Dowell Engineers, providing civil and transportation engineering, land surveying, and planning services, on the web at dowell.com. Working late? Hear Alaska News nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
Three state lawmakers went on record this week saying the state of Alaska should file an amicus brief with the U.S. Supreme Court, urging the court to order ExxonMobil to pay interest on the more than $500 million punitive damages judgment handed down last month in the Exxon Valdez oil spill case. But a state's attorney who has worked on the case ever since the spill thinks it's a bad idea. KMXT's Casey Kelly has more.
Plaintiffs in the case have been trying to figure out if interest will apply to the punitive damages, which the High Court reduced to one-tenth of the original 1994 jury award in its 5-3 decision. Interest could add about $488 million to the award, bringing the total amount close to $1 billion. But this week, Exxon filed a 9-page brief with the court, arguing it should only have to pay interest from the time of the Supreme Court's decision. Anchorage Representative Les Guerra says that argument is a slap in the face to all of the spill victims.
Their lawyers have come up with a frivolous argument that they don't have to pay very much in the way of interest, that they get to delay payment for 15, 20 years and then skate interest-free. So, I felt that the state should chime in and say, look, it's not just the victims of the Exxon Valdez spill who are trying to protect themselves, but the state believes as a matter of public interest that the plaintiffs have been victimized by Exxon here.
On Wednesday, Guerra, along with fellow Anchorage Representative Bob Book and Juneau Representative Andrea Dahl, wrote a letter to Attorney General Talis Kohlberg and their colleagues in the legislature, urging the state to file a friend of the court brief supporting the higher interest amount. Guerra says he hopes the brief would be more than just a symbolic gesture.
Sometimes amicus briefs are symbolic. Sometimes you can come up with an argument that helps a plaintiff with a separate brief that actually substantively helps, and I would hope that that would be the case. For example, it's hard for a victim, somebody who's been victimized, to say they're a victim, right? It doesn't bring a ring of truth. But when an objective third party comes in, when the government comes in and says, no, these people have a truly legitimate claim, I think it adds weight.
Guerra says the attorney general and members of the legislature that he spoke with about the brief seemed mostly supportive of the idea. However, Deputy Attorney General Craig Tillery says the state has decided not to pursue the issue at the urging of plaintiff's attorneys.
We have been in contact with counsel for the private plaintiffs ever since the verdict regarding this interest issue and other potential post-verdict concerns. We have determine after talking to them, it's their view, and it's a view that we agree with, and it's a view that our retained Supreme Court counsel agrees with, that it would not be appropriate for the state to file an amicus for this motion and in this matter.
Nevertheless, Tillery says the state supports making Exxon pay full interest on the settlement and will continue working with plaintiffs' attorneys to make that happen.
And we will do whatever we can in concert with them that would help the clients, the Alaskan citizens, get paid in a timely manner and get paid in full.
Guerra, who worked on the Exxon Valdez oil spill case as an assistant attorney general for the state from 1989 to 1991, says the state's decision not to intervene is surprising to him, especially the reason being given.
Ultimately, I think the decision has to be made in conjunction with the private plaintiffs, so I think their information surprised me, given that it was one of the lead private plaintiffs' counsel who asked us to put pressure on the state to intervene. So, it is what it is, but if there's room for the state to help, I think the state should help.
But the bigger issue, he says, is Exxon's continued use of litigation to avoid fairly compensating victims of the spill. Lawyers for the plaintiffs are working on a reply to Exxon's brief. A decision on the issue could come as soon as the end of this month, when the Supreme Court issues a final decision in the case. In Kodiak, I'm Casey Kelly.
The Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council is calling for the official censure of the five members of the U.S. Supreme Court who voted to reduce the Exxon Valdez award. Earlier this week, Executive Director John Devens sent a letter to Governor Palin asking her to draft a resolution requesting Congress formally censure Justices Souter, Thomas, Scalia, Kennedy, and Roberts. The council members say with or without interest, the award will simply be too small to deter oil shippers from future negligence. Stan Jones, a spokesman for the council, says they realize the resolution wouldn't have the force of law.
Our thinking is that if it were to occur, it would, in all likelihood, be largely symbolic. But nonetheless, it would put the state of Alaska through the governor and then a legislature, which handles resolutions, on the record as saying very emphatically that that decision was just not appropriate.
Congress created the council after the 1989 spill to be a watchdog over the industry. Jones says the council will continue to oppose efforts to weaken punitive damage awards from oil spills.
We filed a friend of the court brief way back in January, arguing to uphold the idea of punitive damages in this case and cases like it, because of our belief that punitive damages, by in effect raising the cost of an oil spill to the spiller, it serves as a disincentive, a deterrent to the kind of risky behavior that led to the Exxon Valdez spill almost 20 years ago and could lead to another spill equally bad someday if the industry gets careless again.
The Supreme Court justified the reduction by accepting Exxon's argument that maritime law should apply to the spill. John Velsko of Homer, who chaired one of the council's committees, says that amounted to judicial activism, which in other cases the High Court has opposed, but not this time.
I was the chair on the Prince William Sound RCAC Legislative Affairs Committee, and we were just discussing this feeling of hopelessness that a lot of Alaskans had on this decision. And since you're maybe a symbolic gesture, but at least it may send a message to these activist Supreme Court judges that their task is to interpret law, not make new law.
The council is made up of 18 member organizations and communities. You can read the letter council members sent to Governor Palin by following the link on our website, aprn.org. More than 4,500 marine vessels pass through the Aleutian Islands each year. The harsh weather and the unique environment put the area at high risk for oil spills and accidents. After the Selandang Ayu grounded in 2004, spilling nearly 340,000 gallons of fuel, a court settlement specified that funds be allocated for a risk assessment of ship accidents and spills. A design for that assessment has now been released. KIAL's Ann Hillman has more.
The Transportation Research Board of the National Research Council has released their design for an accident and spill risk assessment of the Aleutian Islands. Design Committee Chair Keith Michel says there are many suggested ways to reduce risks, from putting rescue tugs at Unimak Pass to increasing inspections.
What is needed is a risk assessment to understand how well those ideas would work in mitigating risk, and also to understand the not only the benefits, but also the cost of implementing those.
Mitigating accident and spill risks in the Aleutians is especially important because over the past 20 years, weather and other conditions have prevented the cleanup of most of the oil spilled in the region. The research board outlines a two-year-long, two-phase plan.
This first phase will look at the traffic and the growth in traffic. It will look at the likelihood of spills. It will look at the scenarios that lead to spills.
They'll also gather input from stakeholders like area residents and members of the fishing and shipping communities. Phase two will be a cost-benefit analysis of the different mitigation plans. However, the design and implementation of a plan is complicated by the number of foreign vessels that travel through the area on innocent passage.
And so in those cases where you want to enact changes that affect the vessels, You have to do it at the international level.
The assessment will be funded with a $3 million court settlement and carried out by the U.S. Coast Guard and the state of Alaska in conjunction with the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo. Manage accounts, pay bills, and get instant loan decisions online at wellsfargo.com. The next stage.
This week on AK, an encore edition from May 2004. Meet some of the seasonal workers who head to Alaska each year and some of the seasonal boat dwellers who fill Alaska's harbors. That and more this week on AK.
Government and military officials are meeting in Fairbanks to talk about a proposed coal and biomass to energy facility. The project, being managed by the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation, or FEDCO, is aimed at relieving the local stress of high oil prices. FEDCO CEO Jim Dodson says the Friday-Saturday meeting is about advancing the project to the national level.
We have invited the congressional delegation, members of the Department of Energy, and people from the Air Force to Fairbanks to talk about the project, just so that, as you know, all of us move forward looking for potential energy solutions, and that the Air Force will know that Fairbanks is interested in this project.
The proposed facility would employ Fischer-Tropsch technology to turn local coal or wood into a low-cost liquid fuel for power generation, heating, and transportation. Dodson says Eielson Air Force Base needs to replace its coal-fired power plant and is already investigating waste-to-energy technology, so it may be a good fit for the project.
They're really not interested in being in the power business or in being in the municipal waste business. What they're, you know, what they're interested in is being the United States Air Force. So if we could help them find solutions to those issues, plus help Fairbanks with this energy problem, you know, it'd be a win-win for everybody.
Dodson says other appealing aspects to working with Eielson are the base's centralized demand for waste heat the Fischer-Tropsch plant would produce and possible access to federal money to help fund the up to $2 billion project. The coal and biomass to energy facility is currently the subject of a study being conducted by Hatch Engineering of Canada. A report is due out in September. The skies around Talkeetna may quiet down now as climbing season ends, Sudio of station KTNA reports.
The climbing season on Denali has come to a close. Base camp has been flown off the mountain. The Llama helicopter has flown to Wrangell St. Elias National Park to assist with activities there. And just a handful of climbers remain up on Denali completing their climbs. A total of 1,272 climbers registered to climb Denali this year. 742 have successfully summited, making for a 59% summit success rate. That doesn't include the 20 climbers still on the mountain. That success rate is much higher than some years, but just on the upper end of average overall. However, it's only the third time in history that many climbers have successfully reached North America's highest peak. This year, a number of unusual climbs occurred. South African Sibusiso Vilani summited, becoming the first South African to do so and completing successful summits on all highest peaks in the world's seven continents. A blind climber, Andy Holzer, summited successfully this year. Peter Hillary, son of late great explorer Sir Edmund Hillary, successfully summited Denali on June 17th, completing successful climbs on the world's seven summits. He dedicated the Denali climb to his late father. Denali was not without tragedy this year. Two Japanese climbers, Tatsuro Yamada and Yuto Inoue, disappeared early in the season and were never found. James Nosti of Illinois and Pukas Tribruno of Indonesia, in separate incidents, suddenly collapsed and died after summiting just in the last 2 weeks. In Talkeetna, this is Sue Dio.
It's high season for agriculture in Alaska, and local produce is abundant. But the operators of one Fairbanks farm are concerned with more than growing healthy food. As KUAC's Laurel Price reports, they're also teaching kids about gardening and giving teenagers meaningful summer work.
Calypso Farm is tucked away in the hills near the southwestern slope of Esther Dome, just outside of Fairbanks. During most morning harvests, you can hear the typical sounds of a farm merge with laughter and lively discussion as the staff and volunteers sort through the fresh pickings. Calypso is a CSA farm. CSA stands either for Community Shared or Community Supported Agriculture. Here, Calypso Farm Director Susan Wilsrud gave me the rundown.
The basic gist is that people pay at the beginning of the season for a share of the harvest. They invest in the farm, and then they get a weekly share of produce throughout the season.
There are currently six CSA farm operations in Fairbanks, and more demand than they can handle. Some farms focus on production, but Calypso's a nonprofit educational farm, so besides tending their own crops and providing food for the community, they also aim at cultivating interest in gardening.
Our goal is not to feed Fairbanks. Our goal is to promote local agriculture.
That's Tom Zimmer, Calypso Ecology Director. He says as part of their effort, Calypso supports other local farms that want to adopt a CSA-style program, and they hold workshops on gardening and farming techniques for people interested in starting family gardens. But a big part of Calypso's agricultural campaign is getting kids of all ages interested in growing their own food. Susan Wilswood said Calypso approached schools 4 years ago about starting their own gardens, but there was a problem.
There's so many benefits, but the biggest question and stumbling block is always who's going to take care of it in the summer. Teachers are off, and then it's this burden. It becomes a burden to the school, a burden to the school district to have this unmaintained garden that fails.
Wilswood says some school districts have the luxury of hiring full-time staff over the summer to maintain the gardens, but most can't foot the bill. The folks at Calypso realized using a CSA model with school gardens could keep them going in the summer while providing fresh produce for the community. Instead of hiring professional gardeners, Calypso trains and hires high schoolers to maintain the gardens and grow enough food for several families. The teens receive monthly wages in addition to shares of the harvest.
So now we've got, Effie Cochran was our first school garden. Now we've got a second one that's functioning as a CSA at Pearl Creek. And then Wood River, Hunter, and West Valley are all in different phases of moving towards that.
Calypso not only helps the schools build their gardens and maintain them during the summer, they also help teachers integrate garden activities into their regular lesson plans. Calypso offers a teacher's reference book called The Living Classroom Manual that's filled with methods and suggestions for using the garden to facilitate math, science, and even language lessons for various grade levels. Teachers also bring their classes on field trips to Calypso Farm, where the kids are put to work in the field.
Our short-term field trips, you know, just kids who come for a day and work, for the most part, they're really excited about anything. Sometimes things that we wouldn't think they'd be, like moving logs and building compost piles.
With a program that has kids of all ages working to feed their community while learning about nutrition and having fun, and all at relatively low expense, Calypso hopes the success in Fairbanks will plant the seed for other schools to adopt similar CSA garden programs. And it might not be that long before school cafeterias are serving food harvested by their own students. And kids are less likely to complain about eating vegetables when they're the ones who grew them. This is Laurel Price in Fairbanks.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Weld Royal in Juneau, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Laurel Price and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Casey Kelly in Kodiak, Mike Mason in Homer, and Sue Dio in Talkeetna. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Gooseberry Peter is our audio engineer. Our intern is Eli Menneker. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Chariot Group, an authorized Polycom partner featuring HD conferencing solutions from its new conference center in Anchorage. Information at chariotgroup.com. Leading a nonprofit organization or tribal government is challenging. The Rasmussen Foundation Sabbatical Program provides nonprofit CEOs and tribal administrators with paid time off to reflect on their work, renew their personal energy, and avoid professional burnout. You can apply or nominate someone you know at rasmussen.org or call toll-free 877-366-2700 for an application. Application deadline is October 1st. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. Miss our newscast today? Listen to APRN's Alaska Morning News, Economic Report, and News Nightly on the web at aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.